Richard Cornell was born in 1927 and spent his childhood in Harford City, Indiana. His father, a Presbyterian minister, died when Richard was nine. He left his three sons with a conviction that they had been put in the world for some purpose and a determination to find that purpose and do something about it. The family moved to California in 1937 and settled on the edge of Los Angeles. Richard attended public schools and worked at odd jobs. Lacking his father's clear call to the ministry, Richard decided in his adolescence to study medicine, not in order to practice it, but to promote its socialization. This flirtation with socialism was brief. His older brother Herb introduced him to libertarian thought, and strongly influenced by Friedrich Hayek's Road to Serfdom and Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, he joined the budding libertarian revival in the mid-1940s. Immediately after his graduation from Occidental College in 1948, Cornell went to New York to study with Ludwig von Mises in his fabled seminar at New York University. He worked as an apprentice to Garrett Garrett, then editor of American Affairs, and his first writing appeared in that quarterly. When Garrett folded the magazine to write his last two books, Richard, groping for his proper role in the libertarian movement, spent 2 years as an understudy at the Foundation for Economic Education with Leonard Reed and Baldy Harper. Then his brother Herb recruited Richard to join him as a liaison officer at the William Volcker Fund. The fund's purpose was to preserve and protect the remnant of libertarian scholars. Richard spent the next few years in the fund's effort to locate these threatened scholars and devise ways to enlarge their influence. His ideas about the libertarian task were changing. His philanthropic involvement made him more aware of the large number of non-governmental, voluntary institutions in American society. He began to wonder whether these forgotten entities might constitute an alternative to the modern welfare state. Cornell decided that libertarians were not involved in a debate, but in a practical competition for results. He set out to demonstrate the forgotten capacities of what he called the independent sector, developing and promoting voluntary alternatives to address challenges such as the hardcore unemployed, the need for low-cost housing, and the renewal of neglected neighborhoods. These efforts all showed promise, and the flagship national program, United Student Aid Funds, which guaranteed billions of dollars in bank loans to college students who could not qualify for commercial credit, was dramatically successful. Richard wrote his first book, Reclaiming the American Dream, which described America's unparalleled machinery for voluntary social action in large, bold terms, not as a useful adjunct to government, but an essential alternative to it. 2 years later, pollster George Gallup said the book had sparked the most dramatic shift in American thinking since the New Deal. Politicians of both parties embraced the independent sector, but as a neglected instrument of the state, rather than an alternative to it. In 1975, Cornell published a much humbler, almost penitential book, Demanaging America, in which he explained the futility of efforts to reform society with the very methods that were constraining it, and described a new kind of society that was developing spontaneously outside the political process. Cornell believes that this spontaneous initiative is now gathering momentum, and a great emancipating social transformation is underway. And the present task is to understand and encourage it. Liberty Fund welcomes you to a conversation with Richard Cornell.
You've been working in the world of philanthropy and libertarian thought for a long time, and we want to go back and see how some of your ideas develop, but I know you've got some current enthusiasms that are taking a lot of your time and attention.
You know, Mark Twain once said that the only thing sadder than a young pessimist was an old optimist. But in my older years, I've become less and less pessimistic and more and more optimistic, sort of reversing that motto. I really believe that there are unmistakable signs all over the place that the society is trying to improve itself, is trying to resolve some of the conflicts that troubled the 20th century in so many different ways. I spent my life trying to be a conscious reformer in various ways that we can talk about later. But what's encouraging about what's happening now is it seems that society is trying to reform itself, and that all those of us who are, you know, sort of dedicated to the idea of a good free society, our role has changed somewhat. We need to help people understand what it is they're doing, develop a rationale for this sort of spontaneous kind of change, and you know, supply a little body English and direction and a helping hand here and there. But it's becoming an entirely different world, I think.
Give me some examples.
Well, I think the moving force. I'm working on a book which will be kind of valedictory. I hope to finish it within the next year or so. I've been working on it for all my life, I guess, in a way, and very consciously for the last 5 or 6 years. But the working title I had on the book was borrowed from the Russian revolutionary Chernyshevsky, who called his, it was curiously a novel, quite a bad novel, called What Is to Be Done, and the subtitle on some editions was Tales of New People. And I think the driving force behind the kind of transformations that I feel so encouraged about is in the character of the people that make up the society. Chernyshevsky, incidentally, was sort of a, you know, quite a bad guy, and because the kind of new people he was talking about were not the sort of new people I'm talking about, but that's aside from the point. But I think that one of the things that's misshapen social life in the 20th century has been a very pessimistic attitude about the capacities of ordinary people that developed toward the end of the 19th century, understandably. We were the biggest, the most rapid industrialization in the history of the world took place in the United States in a period of from after the Civil War till about the turn of the century. I mean, it's astonishing growth. At the same time, the biggest movement of people from all over the world came to the United States, not being able to speak the language, some of them full of sort of revolutionary ideas that troubled the existing establishment. And a society that seemed to be becoming more complex and less comprehensible by the day. So the intellectuals of the time developed a kind of consensus, which I believe guided public policy and private policy in many ways for the whole of the next century, that was based on a pessimistic assumption about the capacity of ordinary people. They thought that they would be unable to deal with these, that the new complexities would create problems that were unfamiliar to them and with which they could not and maybe were unable to deal with. So that led to a kind of canon that said that in this newly complicated age, a lot of social and economic activity was going to have to be regimented. And the canon included the idea of monopoly, concentration of authority, and perhaps most important, the intervention of a layer of professionals between ordinary people and their work or in the important decisions about their lives, where there's the choice of the schools for their children, provision for their health, provision of retirement, all sorts of things. People were thought unable to that, and those responsibilities were gradually transferred to a body of career professionals, which grew up and flourished in the 20th century.
In so many ways, it seems like the late 19th century America was a great triumph of individual liberty and creativity, personal initiative, and yet, as you're saying, all these reformers began to think everything was out of control and chaotic. Where did they get these ideas, and where do they go with them?
The most interesting thing is, and I think there's a kind of, I think there's a wide acceptance of this idea that the model for the kind of social organization that was appropriate to this unexpected new complexity was the corporation. Corporation was developing rapidly. It was very clear, as you say, that this new economy was vastly more productive. I mean, you know, you could see wages double in a single generation or something like that, whereas for centuries they'd be lucky if they increased at all. But the corporation seemed to be the responsible agency, and they attributed what I think in retrospect was a mistaken importance to the way the corporation's interior was organized. And the monopolist thought, the corporate head thought that monopoly was a good idea if he could achieve it. If you were going to control a complicated corporation, the authority had to be, all information and authority had to be concentrated at the top. And they were the first to believe that these people that, you know, came off farms, out of a strictly pre-modern agricultural background, were going to be working in factories. They'd had to be very carefully supervised. So the idea of a layer of professional supervision, between the management and the worker was part of the corporation. At that time, this explosion of productivity was attributed to that method of organization. Rather than, I think it really should be attributed to the fact that the firms were allowed to operate in free markets. In other words, the external affairs of the firm were guided by the free market, a method that invites change, assimilates change very rapidly. The interior of the corporation was organized on an entirely opposite principle, and it was that principle that was used as the model for all sorts of organizations inside and outside of government. A tendency that prevailed by thinking people all through the 20th century that the way to get things done was to monopoly, hierarchy, and professionalization.
Doesn't World War I then sort of show how it could work at a great national crisis?
Exactly. The writer who I found most illuminating on this whole business was Robert Nisbet, and Nisbet points out that the great application of this idea, the great national application of this idea, was in the management of World War I. But I think the great shaping force, the great polarity that defined the 20th century wasn't the ones we think about, Norton, most often. It wasn't capitalism versus socialism. The progressives who wrote the canon weren't for socialism. They were for corporations behaving freely if you gave them a regulatory framework in which to work. But they were for regimentation, an opposite form of for almost all the other activities in the society.
You think there's some changes afoot? Tell us about the changes and give me some evidence, because in a lot of ways it seems like the corporatist model is at its very height. Indeed, you say someplace that the great surprising thing of the collapse of the Soviet Union is that socialism and capitalism have ended up in the same place, in a vast and expanding democratic welfare state, which looks like the triumph of corporatism.
Corporatism did win. It was largely unopposed. Libertarians were clearly in favor of free markets. The first institution to systematically promote the extension of libertarian ideas was called the Foundation for Economic Education. We were talking about the freedom for the corporation to behave in markets. We were silent on this other form of interior organization that guided the corporation. So that method did win, I think. It came to prevail in almost all the major American institutions are organized. If I may at this point introduce a concept that it established as a more accurate polarity, I think, for what went on in American society in the 20th century, and that's the distinction between cosmos, which is the word to describe what's more commonly called spontaneous order, and taxis, which is a term that's more used to be contrived order. So one way to look at the American experience was to say that its economic activity was governed according to cosmos. It's the pursuit of knowledge in the natural sciences was organized according to cosmos. Virtually all the other activities of the society, the organizational model was taxes, hierarchy, monopoly if possible, and professionalization. And moreover, and that's the bad news, people were affected by this. People were altered by it. The American character was altered by the fact that the ordinary American's experience was go to a regimented school, get a job in a regimented corporation, get his health care from a regimented hospital, and it's not surprising that his capacity for exercising his own he wasn't a self-ruling, self-governing purpose. He became rather the passive, benefit-hungry sort of chap that he was assumed to be by the designers of the progressive canon.
So they sort of create the man that they need.
Exactly.
For their ideas to work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, what's happened most recently, and some of us have been watching, hopefully, for it for years, was that the corporations began to change their method of interior organization. The new model was in a way the net. At first, there was a big in the first phase. There was a big, wise and wonderful central computer and a lot of dead-end terminals that could take instruction. Pretty soon, with miniaturization and the rest of it, which happened so slowly in a couple of decades, all the terminals were as intelligent as the center, and it became possible to imagine what nobody could imagine before, and that was an organization that had cohesion without centralization, concentration of authority. So you began to see corporations flattening out. And as people became more self-managing than being managed by that layer of professionals, there's all that, you remember all the many middle managers that got canned in the 80s and 90s, you began to see the character of the people altered, you know? So when I put on my book as a working title, Tales of New People, and the reason for my...
This is the new book that you're still to work on.
That I'm still to work on. That suddenly these new people will make it possible to think about an entirely different kind of society that's ordered in a way that doesn't repress personality, that doesn't eliminate invention, and really makes it possible for us to pick up again the idea that very ordinary people could live very extraordinary lives, which was the idealism that you find so much in 19th century literature.
You said earlier that one of the reasons why the corporatist, progressivist view of things became such a fixture of the American outlook in the 20th century was that there wasn't any opposition to it. And you were part of a rather small group of people, but that began to put together some intellectual opposition to it in the middle and late 40s.
The first thing that sort of determined the trajectory of my life and work was that my father was a minister of the gospel, a Presbyterian minister in a little county seat town in Indiana. He died when I was 9 years old. And like a lot of other progressives did, because a lot of the early progressives were ministers' sons who lost their faith and decided to express their humanity through, social reform. That was very much a part of my background. I felt like I couldn't really honorably be a minister. So what's the next best thing? And I thought about being a doctor and so forth. And I think that's what made me, for my whole life, I pursued the idea in one way or another, but I was a do-gooder. I wanted to make the world more habitable for people.
And after your father died, I guess that part of your life, of your youth, was in Southern California, where so many different peoples did come together, where so many new things were happening.
Then the war came along. My older brother was, who I absolutely worshipped, was became a sort of father and brother to me, because he was 7 years older. I was 9, he was 16 when my father died. So when he went off to war, he started reading. He was out in the Pacific Island and reading various books. And among them was the Road to Serfdom. Mm. And I think I got drawn to that sort of libertarian view simply because I thought my brother could never be wrong about anything, and so I just
this is Herb.
Got it. This is my brother Herb, and that's what opened the door. Herb was not such a mystery. Who was a mystery was the guy that got Herb interested in the libertarian movement, which almost didn't exist then. It began right just toward the end of the war, right, as I understand it, or as my experience suggested. Herb had worked before he went into the Navy for a guy named Lauren B. We all called him Red Miller, who worked for in those days, I think they're not as active as they once were, but most cities had a privately financed kind of watchdog agency who would keep track of municipal performance. And Miller ran that organization, and Herb, when he got out of college, got a scholarship to a course in public administration at the University of Denver, and was assigned to Kansas City to do a study of the Cookingham City Manager's office that had succeeded the horrible Pendergast machine, which Miller had been very important in running it out of town. During the time he was running Pendergast out of town, his front man was a local businessman named Harold Luno, who eventually became the head of a foundation called the William Volcker Fund, which was one of the first entities that began to realize that the rationalization of a free society was in danger of getting lost, because academics had so completely gone over to an alternative view, that the sort of preservation and expansion of it was an urgent task. And this foundation, acting on the advice of Miller, made that a specialty, and Herb was the first director of the Volcker Fund.
So you went to work for Volcker also?
Yeah, after a while. I did various other things. I went to the great almanac of libertarianism was Ludwig Mises. He was teaching in a seminar in New York City, and when I got out of college, I went to study with him for a couple of years. I worked on a periodical that was more conservative, perhaps, than libertarian in those days, called American Affairs, which was published by a wonderful old writer and editorialist named Garrett Garrett, who was very important.
So you worked for Garrett Garrett for a while and attended the Mises seminar.
Yeah.
And Mises himself, I guess, had been supported by the Volcker people at that point. Who were some of the other people in New York in those days? And what was going on? Looking back on it, do you find exciting?
Well, it was a very exciting time. There were very few people. I used to say that we would have fit in a phone booth, and that was not so far. It was not much of an exaggeration. But the people there were all wonderfully kind of eccentric and outspoken and different, and we had a great sense of camaraderie, because we were all fighting this enormous losing battle but enjoying the doing of it. Murray Rothbard was a part of that group, and Rose Lane was somebody I visited in Connecticut often, and Henry Hazlitt, who was a Newsweek columnist who wrote a bestseller called Economics in One Lesson.
Frank Meyer, was he involved there?
Yeah, Frank, parallel to at that time, there was almost from the beginning a clear division between conservatives and libertarians. Some of the younger libertarians thought were sort of anti-conservative, because we were thinking in much more revolutionary terms, not in the violent sense, but in the sense that we wanted to really change the society. We had a much clearer vision of hell than we did of heaven. I mean, we knew what was bad about a centralized society. We weren't nearly as articulate about what a good society would be like. But I think the unease I felt was one of the things that kept me looking for other dimensions that weren't being covered. Although at the time I was an absolutely loyal, card-carrying, unreconstructed libertarian.
Where do these other chances develop? Where, because they did. You moved away from just being a part of that narrow libertarian movement in Manhattan.
What happened was that we had decided. Hayek had written an essay called "The Intellectuals and Socialism," which was a sort of a book on strategy. You know, what's the real way to extend this movement? And Hayek didn't put it this way, but what we got out of it was that it was that any mass movement that didn't have an intellectual base was doomed from the beginning, and that there wasn't any intellectual base for free markets, at least not a very solid and visible one. And that was an absolutely primary task. So Miller, who I mentioned earlier, is my brother's first mentor. And although nobody knows where Miller came from, he just came out of the blue somewhere.
There are lots of people out in the Midwest like that in those days.
Right.
Shouldn't have been a surprise.
And he persuaded the guy who ran the Volcker Fund, Harold Luno, who had been his partner in the Pendergast ouster. To specialize in identifying and helping libertarian scholars. And we marched out, you know, with our checkbooks, thinking this was going to be easy. It turned out there weren't very many left, and it became...
But you actually set out systematically to find these.
Yeah. We put a little team together, a remarkable bunch of people, four of them, Murray Rothbard, Rose Wilder Lane, Frank Meyer, and the fourth was a wonderful Hungarian, George de Husar. And what was characteristic, the surprising characteristic of all four of these people, all four, was that they slept in the daytime and worked all night. And we used to say that, but Rosalind probably didn't sleep at all. We couldn't imagine how she could get as much done as she did if she did. So they read tons and tons of journals and forests and looking for somebody that made a suspiciously libertarian sound, and if they did, we'd follow up and read their work more carefully and then eventually visit them. And in time, we developed contacts with several hundred, if not a couple of thousand, of people who needed to be encouraged in various ways. Some of them were senior scholars that we simply wanted to expose younger scholars to for instruction and the rest. And I think we made an important contribution. I think in retrospect, knowing what we know now, it wasn't quite what we intended to accomplish, but we accomplished a very important thing. And that was that when the Russian economy finally collapsed, you know, Mises had said it was bound to collapse in the essay in 1922 or something like that, we had a ready-made, widely understood, acknowledged rationale for why it failed, and had that not existed, probably that collapse might have been read wrong and think, well, they just had the wrong guys, and there was nothing the matter with the centralized method of national economic planning.
That so the Volcker people had begun 40 years earlier to find the people to put together what would become that explanation.
Yeah,
remarkable. But
as we did that, and as we got better at it, and as it became more routine, it also became more expensive. And at the beginning, we were so unsuccessful in finding people that we had more money than people to give it to. But as our knowledge of this population grew and grew, we needed more and more money. And so we began to look jealously at the part of the foundation's money that had traditionally been spent for welfare, you know, conventional welfare mm-hmm. activities. So we began to figure out ways to get that money into our side of the office instead of the other side. But instead, it caused me to realize, an embarrassing admission at this stage of the game, but we began to realize that there was out there an alternative to to government action on social problems, which we had never, oddly enough, had never really, it wasn't in our consciousness.
They were already there, at work.
We'd all driven by hospitals and private colleges and private agencies and gave to the United Fund. But we didn't, we just thought that was part of the furniture or something. It wasn't thought to have any, there was nothing in the sociological literature about it to speak of. It was just there, and it had become so much a part of American life, it was invisible. So that caused me to think, and then suddenly it satisfied my, not only my sort of libertarian, freedom for everybody impulses, but my do-good impulses, because it looked like there was at least a vestige of an alternative to the state in solving the problems of people that were in real distress of some sort or other. So I got very excited about this this phenomenon as I saw it. Began to try to educate myself about its scope and possibilities and the rest of it, and a kind of theory about how we both that led me to what led eventually to the publication of my first book, and the most popular book I ever wrote, which was Reclaiming the American Dream.
1965?
65, yeah. Right.
So you've been thinking about it, this issue, for some time before you actually wrote down the book.
I thought about it, I kept thinking about it, and then I decided it was a hell of a good idea. But I decided that it wouldn't communicate if it were just an abstraction. If I just went around and told, well, there's an alternative here, and why don't you get busy and do something? I thought it would only have bite if we could point to an example. If we had said we're going to put the eight ball in the side pocket and did. We decided to mount some demonstrations of the neglected power of a force in American life that was underutilized.
And which you called then the independent sector.
Yeah. Frank Meyer was there when I did. I knew it had to be, Tocqueville had written about it. Tocqueville had written about it in the 1830s, about the thing that he thought was most remarkable about Americans was when something went wrong, they didn't call on a man of rank or the police or something. They formed their own group and did something to it. He seemed to call it a kind of propensity for organization or something, but he didn't really give it a name. So I thought this kind of activity needed a name, and Galbraith had just published a very widely read book, or at least read by Galbraith, called The Affluent Society, and he suggested we look at the world with as being composed of two forces. One, the public sector, by which he meant all governmental agencies, and the private sector, by which he meant commerce. And this meant that this whole, middle kind of activity that was neither governmental nor commercial had no identity, no name.
Galbraith hadn't noticed it either.
And Galbraith hadn't noticed it either. And nobody else had noticed it.
So you go off to set up a demonstration project.
Yeah, we set up several.
And who is we? Is this still the
Well, this was fund, a or? Ridiculous little band of quixotic idealists. There was a guy named Bill Johnson who worked with my associate, and then I had some very important volunteer help from businessmen, particularly in Indianapolis. And then four or five other people. And we started several projects. We started one I think it was in Knoxville, that had a private alternative to urban redevelopment. It was a scheme that decay seemed to be contagious. One building would go down and the other one. But it wasn't so hard to reverse it. It was hard to build, to restore one building when all the rest of the buildings. So some wonderful social inventor had figured out a way that you would trade your deed to a building within this area that they were trying to redevelop for stock in a corporation, so you had a stake in the whole thing rather than just the one thing. We bankrolled that and reported on it. Success was very successful. But this is entirely non-government. It wasn't based on eminent domain or anything of the sort. Just my phone. Then Then we did an employment program in Indianapolis, and our ambition was that we wouldn't consider anybody unemployable, and that we'd try to, if we really called them unemployable, we'd find out something to do for them, but we really would like to find work for, we would like to solve the employment problem, in at least in one labor market. But the big one was, our big demonstration was came to be called United Student Aid Funds, and it's because we perceived that student loans to pay for your education was very much in disrepute, and they weren't widely utilized. But our study showed that they could be useful, and that they hadn't been used often because they had too sort of the restrictions on them were kind of silly, and because they colleges had a bad reputation for paying them back and so forth. So we copied a formula that was pioneered in Massachusetts, where you put a fractional reserve in the bank that gave value to your co-endorsement of a loan to a student, which would kind of ensure the bank that it was going to be repaid. And then we enlisted a lot of banks, most of the states, wasn't it? It was never entirely national because there were other organizations that stopped. Called it United Student Aid Funds, and raised a lot of reserve money and made and guaranteed billions of dollars worth of loans.
You talk about United Student Aid Funds in your first book, Reclaiming the American Dream, but you talk about a lot of other things too. And really, it's a great vision about what the American Dream has been and might be again. How did you come to write that book?
I thought, in my naivete, that it was that I was going to start a revolution. That I said in the chapter, if there's one man like the guy who helped me do this, put this thing together, there are probably 1,000 more, and they could change the whole face of the nation. And I really believe that. I mean, The logic of what we did was that here's a rationale here's a big neglected asset, people that are not only able to help but are willing to help, anxious to help almost. It's the kind of thing we saw the other day. I think I said in that book for the first time, in any kind of situation where some identifiable individual is in trouble, and the way to be helpful to that person is obvious. There's no arguing about it. You don't have to go to social work, get a degree or anything. You just go do it. When there's a situation like that, Americans' response is always enormous. I mean, gigantic, excessive even, So I was saying, look, if we've proved in United Student Aid Funds that a handful of eccentric guys can put together an organization that meets the whole reasonable need for student loans, acting the way we did. Think of what we could do altogether if that got popular. We proved it can do it. And I thought there'd be a lot of imitation. I really did think, because I got a lot of mail, I got a lot of lecture invitations. I was running around all over the place making speeches and so forth. And I really thought I had started a movement. The reality was that I don't know of a single entity that was inspired by that point of view or that challenge at all. One of the things I regretted forever, although it was a fabulously important lesson, was that the people who were most interested in it were politicians. I was seduced by the politicians. I mean, they this rhetoric is great, and people love it, that we're going to get private action on public problems and save money and the rest.
Public-private partnership.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. So we learned a lot of how to make voluntary action work, and we also learned about how not to promote it. Its extension, I think. But I was still puzzled about what the right way to extend it was, and an enormously illuminating flop.
About 10 years after Reclaiming the American Dream, you do another book, I guess not quite 10 years, Demanaging America, which is a, I guess from my point of view, a more gloomy book, based, I guess, part on some sobering developments that took place through the United States Student Aid Fund experiment and other things.
Well, I think the motivation for the book, I wrote it, you know, after all this stuff collapsed and all these, this federal effort just kind of fell into rubble after a brief trial. I was very discouraged. I had been so sure that I was on the right track. I was trying to make the point that if the society is going to improve itself in this way, it's probably going to do it by itself. It's going to do it as more and more people begin to feel the inadequacies of the, you know, of present social arrangements and find ways to act on their own in ways that nobody else could devise and the rest of it. It was more something that the society as this, I think I was beginning to realize that when you say you're going to be a reformer, when you're going to reform the society, you've got to know a hell of a lot about the metabolism of the society. I mean, who it listens to and what makes it move in different directions rather than stay. It's a complicated. I mean, American society, it's a lot of things, but one of the most complex society probably in the history of the world by far. I mean, the number of organizations that are involved in different ways. So I think I was beginning to imply that if the country got any better, it wasn't going to be because guys like me, you know, ran around with manifestos about what they ought to do next or something like that. It was going to happen because the dissatisfaction got to be wider and wider, more deeply felt, more important than the rest of it. And that is exactly what happened. I mean, the reason for this illegitimate optimism that I talked about at the beginning is that I think there are signs now that people are changing, their character is changing as their work arrangements become as self-management, self-ruling people replace the kind of proletarianized population that came out of the machine age.
You coined the phrase independent sector to describe what was going on in Reclaiming American Dream, and I don't think you like that phrase very much. Is it itself too much a taxis kind of word?
The problem with the terminology is it puts government and society on two different, on the same plane. You know, there's a government sector and then there's a thing. And my thinking is exactly contrary to that. I think that society is the enduring primary structure of the society. I think the society, we the people of the United States, do hereby ordain and establish a government that we give certain powers to. It's understood that we can withdraw those powers when we want to, either by voting or by revolution or something like that. But the elemental thing is the society. The state is a separate thing, distinguished by its use, its ability to tax and command. So I don't want to talk about the independent sector anymore. I want to talk about state institutions, and I want to talk about voluntary institutions. Some of the voluntary institutions are profit-seeking. Some of them are half and half. Some of them are co-ops. Some of them are mutual aid organizations that don't have no eleemosynary ambition. They just want to help each other. A rich array of these things. I think it's desperately important that there more social self-consciousness develop, that people more realize what the nature of the society is.
Let me ask you another question. It's a bit complicated.
That's right.
It's just something that's troubling me back with Reclaiming the American Dream. You said later on, a little article you wrote in 1991, thanks in large part to libertarian scholarship, there's a well-understood alternative to the strictly economic half about the traditional socialist program, state operation of the nation's economic institutions, and so forth. And there is a well-traveled pathway to change. Then you go on to say, but privatizing the other half of the socialist program, the social services, the democratic welfare state that you say has become the common institution of the Western world. When the last state enterprise has gone private, the part that is practically indistinguishable from the West's social service states is another task. It's a task of another order altogether. If there are alternatives to the state's failing efforts to get rid of Skid Row, eliminate involuntary unemployment, eradicate illiteracy, provide reasonable pensions, treat the indigent sick, detoxify the environment, and you go on with quite a list here, and you have a list in Reclaiming American Dream of all these things, too. Now, I think the conservative with a small c might say, this is a bit utopian. These aren't problems to be solved and conditions to be eliminated. These are the nature of humanity, that you're trying to bite off too much, that a lot of these things can't be ended, can't be dealt with. They're intractable parts of the human endeavor. And all they can be is ameliorated. And the promise too great a change is going to fall into the progressive trap itself. Does any of that ring a bell?
Well, it rings a bell because it was an issue that I hadn't really thought through till recently. Almost from the beginning, I was what I'd call maybe a philosophical libertarian at the beginning, just believing that it was being free and man's power over man ought to be strictly limited.
That's a good place to start.
It was not a bad place to start. It's a bad place to finish, but it's not a bad place to start. Then I was perfectly comfortable with this idea and grateful for it because whereas on Tuesday I didn't have any answer for anything, Wednesday I had an answer for just about everything, which is a great comfort to a kid who just came out of college with a paper that says he knows something. As I read more, I began to develop what was a kind of consequentialist view of libertarianism. And the night I realized this magical circumstances that the morally correct way to organize a society or let a society organize itself was the one that worked better. You know, I'd been somewhat confused by Hayek, who talked about the road to serfdom, and he says the problem is that if you and I wrote him a letter about this. The problem of giving too much money to the responsibility of the state is it'll be turned back on you one day, and you'll be inside looking out. And I said, but that assumes that it works, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said, but if it doesn't work, why don't you say first that it doesn't work, and then say if anybody doesn't understand that it doesn't work, there's a validity about the rule. Isn't our first case to make that free societies work better than controlled societies, and that became my starting point. All this.
Well, what will be the role of the philanthropic institutions in this process? And you clearly in Reclaiming the American Dream see many hopeful signs there, but the world of philanthropy too has become more bureaucratic, more run by professional managers who've had courses in non-profit management, less tied to people who've actually made money themselves that they want to devote to philanthropic endeavor, organized in councils and national meetings, and increasing the leaders articulate a position that sees much of the philanthropic world as the kind of training grounds upon which new government programs will be based. Is there a counter-movement in philanthropy that's going along with the counter-movement in education that's going to help produce some of these changes?
As I see it, the social institutions, in order to be brought up to their proper fulfillment, are going to have to displace the existing social institutions, these taxes-based organizations, which incidentally were usually financed by philanthropic money. that was money that was earned by machine, at the beginning was owned by machine age pioneer capitalists, spent on foundations which thought that it should contribute to organizations that imitated the corporate form. And it was natural for businessmen who thought their prosperity was based on their method of organization that they should be enthusiastic about that. Now the opposite is coming to pass. The challenge now is to reverse the thrust of enterprisers and philanthropists to see what they can do to encourage the formation of institutions of an altogether different sort, and to move responsibility in the opposite direction.
And I gather that's one of the projects that you yourself and your own the foundation you're associated with is beginning to work on and think about ways to encourage that kind of.
Yeah, we've got a little foundation. The first thing you have to do with an enterprise like that is to remind yourself that the beginning of every large enterprise, the first step is always pathetic in terms of the size of the ambition. We often think about the guy that started building, one day started building the Golden Gate Bridge across San Francisco and with a shovel. And they said, what are you doing? We're building a bridge across the bay. It seemed like kind of ridiculous. So, but in a comparatively small way, we're trying to do three different things in this philanthropic effort that are consistent with this point of view that you and I have been talking about. One, where we don't try to direct or contrive any kind of social change. We really try to improve the atmosphere in which enables the society to heal itself and grow new institutions and so forth. We think of that as having three dimensions. Just as the institutions of the commercial sector were built by enterprisers and who was financed by investors, we think these new institutions would be built by social enterprisers, social entrepreneurs, and to some degree financed by philanthropic foundations. And so, in part, we've begun the last couple of years to identify and give special support to entrepreneurs that have shown unusual imagination in taking the most intractable problems and drawing largely on local resources, getting interesting results. And we continue with that. That's the beginning of what we hope will be a long, a larger program of becoming a source of money and encouragement for social entrepreneurs who want to move society in that direction. One thing I started to talk about and diverted myself was that the third activity that we're undertaking in addition to encouraging social entrepreneurship and defining a new kind of philanthropic canon is to try to stimulate scholarly work of a certain sort. This was based on the observation that we know a lot about cosmos in its commercial manifestations, but very little about the rest. So, we found in looking at this wonderfully interesting period, the late 19th century, that toward the end of the century, two things happened. One was that serious social thought retreated from the marketplace into the academy and became, so scholarship was almost exclusively the responsibility of academics. And at about the same time, social thought began to compartmentalize itself, to divide itself. This is a part of that same kind of scientific mentality that was so much in the air at that time. I think now it's become more and more clear that two or three things should happen. One, we should try to break the academy of its monopoly and encourage people outside the academy to do serious work and thought. There are a lot of good examples. Some of the best work in the 20th century, 20th century is done by people outside the academy, like Jane Jacobs and even Lippmann to some degree. I mean, there are many examples. That tradition ought to be restored, and I think that the means to restore it are more and more possible. I mean, work will become less demanding in the sense that to take 6 months off and study or work or educate yourself is more and more possible. The other thing is we think that scholars need to begin to study systematically the metabolism of social processes besides commercial exchange. What's the metabolism of mutualized societies? How do they go? What's the rationale? What are their? We don't know all that. We know that the language is a product of cosmos. It's a phenomenon. It's essential, absolutely essential. Anybody can participate in it. It's not managed. It would be terrible if it were managed. A contrived language wouldn't be very communicative. And there are other examples. But there are many. One of the things I learned in Mises' seminar was that there are many other invisible hands at work in the society, besides the one that directs the capitalist to the right investments and so forth.
Cosmos is such an exciting idea. It does seem like a thought that could be articulated in a public way by some nationally known figure, perhaps a political figure, in ways that would excite a wide body of the American people. And maybe they would even realize it's quite a bit what describes what they do in their daily lives anyhow.
Well, what they've been doing in their daily lives for generations is taxes. But I think the newer generation of people
are working in more organized.
Yeah. Well, in their school life.
Really. And school, and absolutely.
In the institutions where they go when they get sick, and the institutions that they, for almost. And they've been conditioned by that. But I think there's a yearning for. I think there's a terrific yearning for more involvement. The definition of a citizen in the 20th century, that his job was to vote and pay his taxes, and he had very little responsibility beyond that, is a terribly constraining role for a concerned person to fulfill. This, the Cosmos Society just looks for ways to put his or her willing energies to work in some constructive way. That's its appeal, I think.
Daniel Pink, I think, and some other theorists have been pointing how many people now really have taken steps in their own lives to move into that world of cosmos. I think he says somewhere 35 million people self-employed or at least partially self-employed or independent entrepreneurs within a bigger operation. That's startling, and it is becoming a significant figure.
I think the number of people who are self-supervising, which is if you want a single measure of what the future society is going to be like, I think that's a very good one. Because, Jefferson put it one way. He said that people who developed habits of subordination working in factories, Jefferson was fascinated by the efficiency of industrialization, fascinated by it, studied, was always devising little labor-saving gadgets of his own, But he was opposed to the industrialization in the United States because he thought he saw no alternative to hierarchy in the interior organization, and he thought that moving from being a self-ruling artisan or farmer into a regimented factory would cause him to develop habits of subordination that would make him unfit for self-government. Then Hayek later said, "How can you expect to people who have inevitably developed an employee mentality understand the real metabolism of a free society because they're all conditioned in the other mode?" But now that's changing, and that's a very, very important change, in my opinion.
And you think that maybe that realization could be promoted somewhat by philanthropy itself?
Well, yeah, I think you can find things to, I think it's really kind of analogous to growing a plant as opposed to building a birdhouse or something. You can't contrive or build it, but you can encourage it and nourish it and so forth. And that's the philanthropy of the future, I think. There's a lot of talk these days about community. The most publicized form of community that's under discussion is came, came, came in the wake of Robert Putnam's very interesting book about civil participation in Italy. But it's a kind of community that again accepts the modernity's limitation of the role of the citizen to voting and paying his taxes. When they say he wants to get involved, and because he gets involved, to be more, the community he's talking about is a political community. Yeah. It's not a helping community. I think right in the teeth of all that, things they're not measuring are happening in a big way. Mutual aid associations, where you know everybody who's dying of lung cancer in a certain area gets together and helps each other keep their doctors honest and gives you know comfort and advice and support of all kinds. I mean, those are communities when that happens. I've seen them and been part of them.
Dick, your early friend and mentor, Ludwig von Mises, wrote his great book, Human Action, to talk about the nature of the free human spirit. It seems to me like you're now, through some of your own philanthropic endeavors, trying to recreate some of the things Mises told you and wrote about in those days.
Mises was an enormous influence in my life, an abiding influence. There were others, Hayek and so forth, but particularly Mises. I was in his seminar for 2 years and then stayed in touch with him. His wife was my younger daughter's godmother, and we stayed in close touch for a number of years. He was a real scholar and a courageous figure in a way. He came to New York, to escape the Nazi terror, and his compensation was such that he and his wife, who were both opera buffs, could only afford to buy one ticket, and they went an alternate night. But he worked away and kept writing books and the rest. And we all just loved him. I said one time that if it hadn't been for the practical difficulties, we would have carved his notes in stone, you know, listening to his lecture. But one of the things that stayed with me all my life was his lecture that's also part of an important part of Human Action, in which he said that which he talked about praxeology, which is the term for the study of all of human action, the whole circle of human action, and then he'd show a sliver of it, which is human action that eventuated in exchange, which is what we call economics, and which he preferred to call catalactics, and then he'd point to the rest of the circle and saying this is the kind of spontaneous order, the kind of human action that we don't really understand in tabloids. And he was implying that it would, challenging us almost to try to fill in that gap. And now I think what would be intellectually interesting in those days has now half a century later become almost imperative, that we extend our understanding of human societies to these other than economic undertakings.
Well, Dick, it's been good to see you again. It's a lot of fun to talk and to hear these stories, some of which I'd heard before, others which are altogether new to me. And you've just had a remarkable career, and I know it's ongoing, and there are some new exciting things to come. We'll look forward to your new book, which will be here in a year or two.
Magari, they say in Italy.
Exactly.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Take care.